Call the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources to order. Today's February 16th. I think while I've got a quorum, we may go ahead and do our work sessions first. I'm not expecting everyone to remember the content of these bills, so we can have a little explanation of the bills as we go. The first three were all brought by the Oregon Department of Agriculture as kind of housekeeping bills, but... Sorry, I lied. The first one is OWEB, and the second ones are, second two are ODA. The third one has to do with the tribes and vets, which we'll talk about in just a minute. So we're not doing it as a group, so we'll just go one by one. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2327 and ask Misty to refresh us on what this was.
Okay, Chair Clem, members of the committee, House Bill 2327 was a bill that did some statute cleanup for OWEB. It repealed some of the language in the statute that DAS would provide liability coverage to watershed councils. It would allow a representative from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to serve as a non-voting member of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. It makes some changes to what kinds of documents OWEB needs to keep physical copies of, and makes some changes in terms of what data they're providing to the state. There is a proposed Dash 1 amendment, which would allow the last 6 months of the biennium to be included in the report to the governor and the Legislative Assembly.
Okay, so I would take a motion on this Dash 1 amendment.
You want me to?
Yeah.
Oh. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 1/13/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 1/31/17. And again, the Dash 1s allow the... Go ahead.
The Dash 1 amendments would change the due date for the Oregon Plan Biennial Report to the Governor and Legislature from January 15th of odd-numbered years to January 15th of even-numbered years.
So that's the Dash 1s. Any objection to those Dash 1s or discussion on the Dash 1s? Any objection to the Dash 1s? Okay, see, none, so adopted. And then the bill.
Chair Clem.
Vice Chair Springer.
Well, I have no idea where you're at here, but I would make a motion to move House Bill 2327 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Singer moves House Bill 2327 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Not on this one. We went through it.
Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, bill passes. The members not here are excused. Okay, now to the ODA cleanup bills. Bill, let's start with the first one. House Bill 2254, can you remind us what that's about?
Sure, do you want to open a work session?
I should open a work session, House Bill 2254.
Okay, House Bill 2254, Chair Clem and members of the committee, would exempt horticultural commodities that are shipped directly for export from requirements to label each individually packaged unit before shipping.
Okay, how about a motion on this?
Excuse me. Chair Clem, I move that House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? This was so you could label an aggregate rather than every single individual little item. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, passed. I'll figure out carriers here at the end because I'm forgetting that as we go along. Okay, let me open a work session on House Bill 2255 about milk. Tell us a little about milk.
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, House Bill 2255 clarifies Oregon Department of Agriculture's authority to adopt rules referencing the pasteurized milk ordinance and allows the agency to suspend grade designation privileges of milk producers for the first violation of safety standards.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
This one I don't remember.
This is...
I just don't remember it, so can you explain it a little bit more?
Lisa, can you come up?
Mike.
Rep. Brock Smith?
This is just aligning the the ODA regulations for our dairies to the federal USDA law.
So it was basically making them parallel.
Lining them up.
Yeah,
it was just lining them up because we had a few that weren't.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. This is a bill that helps us conform with the federal regulation.
Right, conform. That was what it was. Okay. Just making sure.
You bet. Any other questions?
The title didn't seem the same.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, move that one to the floor. And our last but definitely not least bill, House Bill 2405. And please, Nessie.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, House Bill 2405 would add tribal governments to the list of eligible grantees under the State Parks and Recreation Department's program to construct and restore memorials honoring veterans and war memorials located on public property.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2405 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2405 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
That's good.
Representative Witt, we're talking about the veterans allowing the tribes to be eligible to get grants from the Oregon Parks Department to do kind of veterans road memorial bill.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, we'll send that one to the floor. Okay. Now we may see some people depart the room. It's not because they're not interested, but now that their bills are passed, they probably don't care about us anymore.
Are you going to assign carriers?
I will do that. I just have all these people waiting, so I'll figure that out here while we're getting started with Representative Wilson. So let me open the public hearing on House Bill 2365 and ask Representative Wilson to join us. Tell us about his bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make a motion that Representative Witt be able to vote on the bills.
No, we can do that real quick. Yeah. So we can do that while we're still in the public hearing, I think. So Vice Chair Esquivel moves that the...
Not the Vice Chair, no.
Oh, sorry. Representative Esquivel.
Yes.
The motion is to suspend the rules in order to allow members to vote on the previous bills.
Second.
You don't have seconds in this building.
Oh.
Any objection to the motion? You're seeing none. Representative Witt, 2327, a web cleanup bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I vote.
Derek, you know, it's kind of weird.
Representative Witt, 2327-1.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2254, this was the making sure Ag Department didn't require everybody label every single individual item, but could label like the outside of the carton.
Representative Witt. Aye.
And the 2255 is conforming our milk law policies with the federal milk policies.
Aye.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Great. So, Representative Wilson, tell us about House Bill 2365.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, I appreciate your indulgence today. I'm Representative Carl Wilson, House District 3. To digress for just a moment, Chair Clem, I want to thank you for scheduling this. I understand that a number of you have been papered very heavily on email as a result of this bill. But, Chair Clem, what I'd like to say is I really appreciate the spirit that you approach this in, because, after all, this is the arena of ideas. And when we can't talk about ideas, it's a sad thing. So I want to thank you for taking the time and not being afraid to discuss an idea. I'm not sure that what I'm going to talk about today in an overall sense is a good idea or a bad idea, but that's why we get together and talk about things like this. There's no conspiracy, as many people would have you believe. I just happen to come from a county that's very close to being impoverished due to mismanagement of our federal land base, in my estimation. So I'm here today to ask for a study. I'm not asking for anything other than a task force, a study of whether this idea of transfer of public lands is a good idea or a bad idea, or how it would actually work if somehow the legal question were determined in a way that allowed public lands to come under state jurisdiction. So once again, it's simply a study that I'm asking for today. This would establish a task force to study the transference or conveyance of certain federally managed lands to the state of Oregon. And what I mean, again, is a study. I'd like to learn everything I can about what the mechanism would actually look like if this legal question, in a larger sense, were determined. You're probably aware, and I know you are, but I'll state it anyway for the record, more than 50% of all land in the state of Oregon is under federal management. From the perspective of House District 3, my district, 68% of the land base in Josephine County is federally held. Where once these lands provided a living and a sound commercial base for rural communities, aggressive litigation and excessive regulation have strangled resource-dependent rural economies, devastating our jobs and devastating our way of life. Lack of management of these lands has left them more fire-prone than at any time in history. Our communities are obviously at risk from wildfire, and our tourism economy is shuttered sometimes during summer months due to road closures, smoke itself, and restricted access to trails. Many questions will be raised, and I do understand that this issue is not free from controversy. You well know that by the emails that you've received. Opponents will have their say, and I'm happy for that. The task force would help us learn how this whole mechanism could actually work, or not. But I firmly believe that local responsive control over management policy will generate not only state but local revenue, and also reduce the need for taxpayer subsidies and federal support for our communities, either through payments in lieu of taxes or other programs like secure rural schools, and we don't have much of that anymore. I believe that local management under current Oregon forest practices will result in safer communities whose assets are not imperiled year after year through negligent mismanagement. I believe the state of Oregon will prove capable and willing stewards if this legal question is someday answered. Stewards of the land that we love and have prospered from so much over the years, but simply no longer do. I do think that the whole issue about privatization and are we looking to sell our properties? No, we're not. We're not looking for that at all. In fact, over the years, states have decided that they want to hold on to more of their lands, and I am against selling those lands. State governments have been rapidly expanding, not divesting their land holdings, and I think there's little reason to believe that the federal lands transferred would be passed on to private citizens. I'm certainly not interested in seeing that. Public land will remain public, and let's bring the management decisions home. So once again, I just want to thank you for your indulgence today. There are many questions to be answered in an overall sense, but again, that's not what we're here to do today. The courts will ultimately determine title to federal lands, and a lot of states are pursuing that question. As you know, Utah has done that. Arizona's talked about it. In fact, Utah, getting back to the state of Utah, even passed a bill asking that the federal lands be given to the state. The U.S. government has not responded to that lawsuit. I don't know where that's going. But again, what I'd like to do is simply convene a task force and study if this legal question were handled in an overall sense, what would actually mean for the state to engage in this transfer? Right now, we don't know. We simply don't. State government doesn't often do things prescriptively. It waits until after things happen. I think it would be fun just to find out what it would be like. So thank you again for hearing the bill. And again, I do appreciate your indulgence.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did a little research on this at one time and found out that actually this started with the Articles of Confederation. and then it went on into the Constitution. And the criteria to become a state is you had to meet the criteria, and then you had to set aside so much of your state into a trust by Congress, and they would either sell it off to or homestead it, or they would revert back to the state. I did, you were talking about a bill in Utah. I read a demand letter from the state of Illinois demanding that their lands be given back to the state of Illinois. The date on that was 1825, and the government did give back the lands to the state of Illinois. If you go from Oklahoma and go directly north, anything from that line to the East Coast, there's very little federal land. It's all in the West Coast because they did not return those lands to the state, nor did they let people homestead those lands. So that's the big crest. And then I think in the 70s they passed a law stating that it was under their control. I think Congress passed some kind of a law like that. So I'll be honest with you, we used to have a very vibrant economy, and I remember when I was working my way through college pulling veneer green chain at night, I made $3.74 an hour, which doesn't sound like much, but 1970, but that's equivalent today to $22.88 an hour. So very good wages, good places to work, and yet we've completely shut that off. You have very few manufacturing facilities because today people won't invest capital if there's no raw resource to supplement that. So I would like to see us move forward on this. The spotted owl was used as a vehicle, and they turned out to be a myth with the modeling because the barn owl was actually the culprit.
Representative Rocksmith.
Representative Wilson, thank you for your words here on this issue. As a former commissioner of Curry County, 67% is federally owned and mismanaged, I'll say. And also as a former board member of the Association of Oregon Counties and the district chair for AOC District 4, which represents Curry, Coos, Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson counties, four of which are in under extreme stress because of the lack of federal management of their lands within their borders and of their counties. I don't know how we're going to keep Curry County's jail open after this budget. Coos County has done well as far as managing their timber resource because they have a private forest, but even with those dollars, they have a 249-bed jail facility, but can only afford to operate 49 beds. Douglas County is looking at closing their libraries because they're the largest, county in the state. And Josephine County is on the tip of the spear next to Curry,
yes,
with a serious lack of law enforcement. You add the ONC Act, which manages the 2.5 million acres of land, which is unique to Oregon. We just went through the BLM. It's managed by the Bureau of Land Management, Resource Management Planning process. And I can tell you how, for over a year and a half, how painful that was. Representative Escobar brought up the spotted owl. Under their own research, and it was presented in Medford, they spoke about how, and the representative was correct, it isn't the management of the resource or the logging that occurred, but the infiltration of the barred owl taking over their habitat. And yet, and they know that no amount of conservation will save the spotted owl and the siskiyou, rogue siskiyou range. But they still moved in the most depressed areas, harvests in upwards of 40% reductions in the Coos Bay and Medford BLM districts and moved them up here to the Salem districts and increased. So, and lastly, to offer some other information as far as support for your task force. The Association of Oregon Counties, for the last 2 years, has sent a resolution, and if I remember correctly, last year, unanimously supported by the Legislative Committee of the Association of Oregon County, asking for this task force to be formed to look at the pros and cons of what will occur. You so eloquently stated, no one's looking at selling this land. We just want to have a conversation about what would it look like? What is the process, and how would that happen? The 36 counties of Oregon and their commissioners have been asking for that task force to be formed for at least the last 2 years. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brock Smith, I just have to believe that Oregonians would exercise a much more loving and caring oversight to these lands than our federal partners do right now. We would make the big decisions here in Salem rather than those decisions being made in Washington, D.C. I just have to believe that we would do a better job and we would care more, especially when our forests are incinerating the way they are. And I think we all can see the devastation that is causing the environment, causing our streams, rivers, to have to live in those communities and breathe that air. My radio company is a distribution point for masks for the public to come and get and wear during these times of fire siege. And so, yeah, again, I have to believe that if, in fact, the larger issue at court was determined and Oregon was able to take over these lands, that we would care for it and our people to a much greater extent than a federal bureaucracy would. I just don't see the harm in studying what it would look like. And the elements of the bill tell us the kinds of things that we're going to study and be interested in. So, thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I want to thank you again for bringing it to us. I'm always up for a good discussion, and I always like to look at two sides of the issue. It kind of takes my breath away to think about taking on more responsibilities for management of more forests. And I my other side of my hat as I'm thinking about this is, why don't we get them to do the job of managing the forests that they say are theirs? Because I feel like we need help as far as resources and making sure that we're going to have enough to be able to not just manage but take care of forest fires when they do appear, take care of drought issues when they do appear, and making sure that we have an opportunity to have resources that have to be there. We can't just not manage them. So I'm really in for that discussion of reviewing the management of those forests. But I do want us to keep an open mind that, you know, they say be careful what you wish for. If we did have ownership, or you're bringing more of those forests into the Oregon portfolio, you're also bringing in more responsibility and more needs for more resources. So I'd want a complete, full conversation. And the other issue is just dealing again with the fact that you just got done saying that, what, 63% in your area was
67%
in your area is actually federally owned. I'm not sure if the everyday citizen is going to think it makes a difference if it's federal or Oregon. It's publicly owned. And so another part of the conversation is the difference between public and privately owned. So anyway, I think those are great discussions. I think when we take on a discussion that we also have to take on the fact that there's a responsibility that comes along with choices or ideas that we bring forth as being potentially possible.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I couldn't agree more. Those are good words, and I appreciate that. Given our federal government today, there's a big question mark. We don't know what this government, this administration is going to be like. In light of that, again, I would say I would a whole lot rather Oregonians be taking care of our forests than Washington, D.C. Thank you, Chair Clem, for that idea yesterday. I do appreciate that.
Yeah, I usually try to not inject my opinions and just run the meeting, but I'd like to get every decision away from Donald Trump right now, honestly. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand and appreciate the concern, and it's something that needs to be looked at if this bill moves forward in a study, is the capacity of the state to manage the lands. Very, very relevant point. Keeping in mind that one of the multiple uses of those lands are to generate revenue. So one would hope that under state ownership that the revenue generated would be greater than the revenue generated as the federal government has managed it. And I can't help but sit here and think of the devastation along Canyon Creek in Grant County that I saw, and homes, people's stock, their animals were killed in that fire, federally managed land, extraordinarily out of control fire. I had friends that were evacuated from their homes twice during that fire. And the fire is over and that damage is done, but the story isn't over because now they are in horrendous, they are extremely fearful of the floods. I mentioned Canyon Creek. They're extremely, because of the devastation to the ground and the erosion that's occurring. So I have to admit, when I look at that, I think, is Oregon going to do much worse than that?
Okay, so I've got a couple technical questions. I think I have been thinking about this maybe slightly differently in my head, so I'm glad we're talking about this. When we're talking about the courts deciding, that's around this theory that maybe the states are entitled to these lands, you know, through some past promises or agreement to enter in the union. Do you consider, how can I say this the right way? Okay, let's a hypothetical. If I don't buy that at all, which I don't believe that, do you consider it reasonable to talk about whether it's a good idea to have the state buy the lands, just like any person could make an offer to buy lands, versus do we? So you're not saying in the study that we own it. It's more like if the courts decide we actually do have rights and we get it, then what would we do with it? I guess my question is, if the courts decide we don't own it, is it still worth talking about? Maybe should we buy it? For example, we bought this Gilchrist State Forest from a private timber company years ago. I voted for it. Probably a lot of us did who were there at the time. And we, I believe, are in the black, having bought a private forest and managing it. I don't know why I think Fidelity owned it or no. Anyway, some timber company owned it. We bought it. We seem to be doing well with it. So are you opposed to the idea of if the task force were to study, is it wise to buy it to get it under our ownership rather than sort of this legal theory that we may get it anyway for free?
Chair Clem, thank you for the question, for the thought. I think given the Oregon budget right now and where we are, I don't think we can afford to buy anything under any circumstance. Theoretically, if we had a different budget situation, pay as we go or buy what we can, sure. But again, I don't see us being able to buy anything at this point. And I know you know that and understand that. Again, I don't think that this question, because it's an open legal question about the federal lands, I don't think it's going to come to trial for quite some time. And so I do believe it would behoove us to at least talk ahead of time to be somewhat prepared if that did happen. We've all been around state government to know that we don't often do things prescriptively. We wait, we hit the wall first, and then we play catch up. And so in that vein, I would like to see us plan ahead just in case.
So my thought is, again, I'm not a judge and I'm not a lawyer either, so could be, don't know. I just don't think so, but who knows, right? So sure. Is there harm? I think my thought was, is it worth talking about the way we did the Gilchrist, which was also not during a good budget time? You use revenue-backed bonds, you buy the forest, you manage it better, you pay the bonds with the revenue. So it doesn't actually touch, doesn't have anything to do with our $1.8 billion shortfall. It's whether you have revenue-backed bond capacity to buy something and get enough revenue to repay the bonds. Because I would admit we should not be using general fund to go buy new things at all right at the moment. We should be figuring out how to balance our budget as the Constitution requires. Yes. So that's all I was envisioning. We were going to talk about that. Secondly, I just want to confirm your vision, if there were to be a transfer, was that it be managed better by, let's say, Oregon Department of Forestry, not sold off to other entities.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. We got a lot of people that came. Some came a really long way to talk, like Dan Morse, who's from over 100 miles. We'll get him up here in just a second, and then others. So any further questions for our colleague? Thank you for bringing ideas. When we have local control of GMO Day, I expect 25 times more people, a lot from your part of the world, so you're welcome to come back that day, too.
Thank you. I'll certainly be there.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. So, Dan, can you join us, our guests from over 100 miles, and then I'm just going to go down the list. John Williams and Sean Stevens, can you join Dan? On deck is Kirk Richardson, Mike Savaggio, and Tom Wolfe. Welcome. We always try and get people from over 100 miles in first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Bend is just a touch over 100 miles away, and I'm pleased to be here this morning, enjoying the rain. Chair Clem, members, my name is Dan Morse. I am the Conservation Director for Oregon Natural Desert Association. We are, in fact, based in Bend. We exist to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert. On behalf of our more than 6,000 members and supporters from across Oregon and indeed from around our country, thank you very much for visiting with us today. I will try to bring that desert perspective to the discussion. As many of you may know, more than half of our state are those desert lands, more than I think it is 30 million acres, and of those, some 12.5 million are managed by the Bureau of Land Management. I welcome the discussion of ideas, and we as an organization engage in those discussions each and every day. And we welcome this chance to discuss this idea in particular. HB 2365, as we understand it, would establish a task force to study the transfer of federal land to the state or perhaps to private ownership. The bounds are uncertain. On behalf of our more than 6,000 members and supporters, I want to be very clear from the outset. We strongly oppose HB 2365 and the fundamentally flawed concept that it represents. We are opposed to the broad-scale disposal or transfer of American public lands, whether it is to the state, to other levels of government, or to private entities. The ultimate outcome of this bill would not be state management of these lands. In fact, it would be the future sale of our public lands when the state can't reasonably afford to manage them. I think this is an example that rings very true in this moment. And a thought occurred that in the discussion of ideas, we ought to look to our best available information. And I wanted to bring up the fact that the Conference of Western Attorneys General of the Western States did prepare a detailed report on this question, the legality of this transfer of public lands in 2016. That report was released in September last year. The composition of that committee of attorneys general was a mixed partisan composition, and by an 11-1 vote, all of those attorneys general recommended the approval of this report, which unequivocally stated that the transfer of these lands is at best a questionable legal theory, more likely an impossible task, an illegal task. And so if we look to those experts and we understand the foundation upon which this argument purports to be built, I think we can see that this is an idea that's already being examined quite thoroughly by people who are more expert than me, certainly. And I think given those legal realities, what we've seen in other states where land transfer proposals like HB 2365 have come up has been fierce opposition from a broad array of people of all political persuasions, and those people are caring for our American public lands. If HB 2365 receives continued consideration, I will assure you of what I know, that ONDA's members and supporters care very much for their public lands, and they will be here day in and day out to voice that support and to urge you strongly not to consider the transfer of these lands in any form. As I stated, the 31.5 million acres of public land in Oregon provide immense value for our state. They provide economic benefits, ample space for outdoor recreation, and they are central to our way of life here in Oregon. From hiking and biking to hunting and fishing, we love to get outside, we love to enjoy these incredible places, and they are what make our state an incredible place to live. And it's because of those values that we know we don't need a costly, taxpayer-funded task force to tell us what we already know. Transferring American public lands to state or local governments or private entities would be a bad deal for Oregonians. Right now, as has been stated, we face a $1.8 billion shortfall, and we're considering the sale of public land at the Elliott State Forest. In that light, it would seem highly fiscally irresponsible to consider attempting to seize millions of acres of additional public lands and then take on a massive financial liability that would come with it. The costs for state land management, for fire suppression, and the other critical needs would be tremendous. We've seen time and again in studies from other states that the cost to states of this type of transfer would be hundreds of millions of dollars each year. An analysis of transferring public lands in Idaho and Montana, which have roughly the same amount of public land as our state in Oregon, found that there would be an additional $111 million and $367 million, respectively, in management costs for those states. Here in Oregon, transfer of those our public lands could cost Oregonians $75 million a year in firefighting costs alone. Clearly, those huge costs can only be shouldered by the federal government, and that's fair because these lands belong to all Americans. So I'll end with this. Not only is our state ill-equipped financially to manage these lands, the complex responsibility of managing these lands is also best handled by the federal land managers. And our best role as citizens is to ensure that those federal land managers are careful stewards of the lands, consult with us as Oregonians, and work to improve their management. We would be best served if our state would press on our Congress to support these underfunded agencies and manage our public lands and national forests as we urge them to. That adequate funding would ensure their appropriate care. So today I urge you to oppose HB 2365 and turn your energies instead toward working collaboratively with Oregon's congressional delegation and our federal land management agencies so that we can actually solve the most challenging issues on Oregon public lands. That collaboration is our best path to success. And not only that, it's the Oregon way. Thank you, Chair Klum.
Thanks. And then I've got John Williams next.
Hi, good morning, Chair Klum and members of the committee. I come to you from near Lebanon, Tennessee School Drive. I'll turn that back, sorry. So first and foremost,
John, I have to have you say your name.
I'm sorry. It's John Williams, and I'm from near Lebanon. First and foremost, I oppose all transfers of federal public land to state governments. Let's get that out of the way. And so yesterday when I was reading about this bill, I actually called the BLM and asked how many people they employed in the state of Oregon. And they employ about 1,500 full-time permanent employees. And according to the Statesman Journal article from April 15, 2016, the state of Oregon pays each employee about $89,000 per year, including benefits. And so that would just be $133,500,000 just to cover the BLM land if we were to, you know, hire on people in that manner, which we have a $8 billion deficit, and then with $21 to $22 billion deficit in PERS, so I have no idea how the state could even think to take on that type of responsibility. And then also, is Representative Wilson still?
He is. Yeah.
Would it be acceptable to ask him a question to clarify?
Not really. He'd have to come up and sit up here so the mic could record it. You could ask a rhetorical question and then go talk to him later if you want.
How about Representative Escoval? Could you clarify Section J, the potential for the cost of a federal land transfer to require the state?
The best thing would be for you to give us your testimony because there's a lot of people that want to talk right after you.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So I guess I'll just go to the last part. So on a more personal note, I'm a combat veteran. I served as an infantry marine in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the thought of getting home is what, you know, pushed me through every day. And it wasn't just my family and friends, but it was the public land in Oregon, the federal land in Oregon, that I wanted to get back to. And so the idea, especially given the state's inability to manage state land like the Elliott State Forest, this would end up being a privatization scheme. I mean, there's no other way around it. And so I want to thank you guys for your time. And
great. Thank you, Sean.
Chair Clinton, representatives of the committee. My name is Sean Stevens, executive director with Oregon Wild. And I'm going to echo a little bit of what Dan and John and probably others have said today, but hopefully also give some examples, concrete examples of the management that we're talking about between federal lands and state lands or private lands that are governed by state law. I'll start off by saying that on behalf of our 20,000 members and supporters, I'm here today to strenuously oppose HB 2365. This bill, like many other copycat measures across the West, is part of a very disturbing trend aimed at slowly chipping away at America's public lands heritage. This idea of transferring America's public lands to state or county governments has been strongly rejected by organizations and individuals from across the political spectrum, from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation to Oregon Wild to our aforementioned President Trump. That the Oregon legislature, representing a state whose modern economy and quality of life is rooted in the use and enjoyment of our public lands, would consider HB 2365 and forcing taxpayers to pay for a study of this idea, to us is deeply troubling. It's even more so when we consider that we're just barely a year removed from the armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge by the Bundys and their gang of militant anti-government extremists. The Bundys preached a warped view of America's public lands, one that results in all of us, whether we are hunters and anglers or hikers and equestrians, losing access to these areas forever. HB 2365 appears to embrace the ideas of the Bundys and promote the view that public lands have no value beyond logging, mining, livestock grazing, other extractive industry. And as has been mentioned, the timing is somewhat ironic because the Elliott State Forest on Tuesday moved towards privatization, and it shows that there's evidence that the state might not be the best place to transfer public lands that we value for all sorts of reasons right now. To get to that management question, I think it's been suggested here today and before that Oregon's natural resource agencies, including our Department of Forestry, are more effective land managers than the United States Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. And I believe this reflects a poor understanding of the reality of how state and private lands in Oregon are managed. I know members of the committee are likely familiar with the version of Oregon logging that is presented by the Oregon Forest Resources Institute and their ads, but I brought a few images today that hopefully give a little bit of perspective on what we think is the reality of management in Oregon. So this is the Siusla National Forest in the Coast Range. It's actually the proposed Devil Staircase Wilderness. And HB 2365 would explore transferring this land to the state, presumably so it could look one day like this, which is the nearby private land managed under Oregon's Forest Practices Act. This is an image from the Mount Hood National Forest, where federal land managers are required to balance recreation, clean water, endangered species, and logging to serve multiple needs. And this is how the Department of Forestry in Oregon has managed the Elliott State Forest, with vast clear cuts that muddy water, deplete salmon runs, and degrade hunting and fishing opportunities. Only got two more. Contrary to some of what we've heard today and some of the doomsday proclamations about the lack of management on federal land, we have extensive logging on federal land today. It just looks different than it used to. This is a picture of a thinned plantation forest on the Siusla National Forest in the Coast Range, where careful logging provides jobs in the woods while restoring forest health. And we can compare that to examples of soil damage from the logging that's currently happening on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest after clear-cut logging there in recent years. I'll close by saying that a century ago, a visionary generation of American leaders from both political parties created our system of national public lands precisely to protect them from provincial special interests who would degrade and diminish them for short-term profit. They knew full well that if the fate of our public forests, wildlife areas, and grasslands were left to the states, these areas would be degraded or lost forever. Every weekend, tens of thousands of Oregonians head out to enjoy these treasured public lands. We lace on our hiking boots, pick up our hunting rifles, put on our waders, and take advantage of the foresight of those elected leaders a century ago. The current generation of Oregon leaders should not turn their backs on that vision by entertaining HB 2365 any further. Thank you.
Any question for these gentlemen? Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, before I do, will we be having anyone, witnesses before us that can speak to the legal history and ownership of federal lands in Oregon?
Not really. I mean, there are people who might give you their opinions, but there's no legislative counsel, nobody. I don't know. Tom, are you a lawyer? I don't think so. A fisherman, I know that. But I don't think so.
All right. May I?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. Mr. Morris, you talked about a report from the 12 Western Attorneys General. Do you recall if in that report there was any discussion of the history of ownership of lands in the state of Oregon?
I do not recall specific mention of lands in the state of Oregon, and I should say, Chair Kleinman, Representative Witt, I am not an attorney, so I would not pretend to interpret that report for you. What I would note is that it was a thorough discussion about the constitutional basis for federal ownership of public lands, and I think it is a worthy reference to this committee.
Thank you.
Representative Witt, if I may.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Chair Clement, Representative Witt, the Attorney General report does have some history. There's also a Congressional Research Service report issued in the last 2 years that has an in-depth history of how Western states came to have federal public lands in their states. That's pretty exhaustive, and I can send that along to the committee if you're interested.
Follow-up. Do you remember whether or not that report would describe ownership of present federal lands as ever having been owned by the state of Oregon?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I'm not totally sure. I would imagine that it would get into the history, and some of these lands are pretty complex in their history, depending on how they came into federal ownership. But it would probably touch upon the course of the big chunks of land and how they flowed throughout time. Most of that land, the big chunks, were always federal.
Additional question.
Sure, follow-up.
Mr. Stevens, has Oregon Wild ever filed suit against a federal timber harvest plan in the state of Oregon?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, certainly we have, yes.
If lands that are currently owned by the federal government were found their way to be state-owned lands, would that in any way inhibit Oregon Wild from filing future challenges against federal forest management plans?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, it's a really good question because if this were to happen and federal American public lands were transferred to the state and potentially to county governments or sold off to private companies, there would be a different set of regulations that would they would be managed under, and so it would be a different paradigm that we would have to look at if we were caring about the management of these lands. I think your question gets at one of our greatest concerns, which is that the way that American lands are managed now is under a series of laws that are aimed at protecting different resource values, whether it's the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, or the various public participation laws. And those allow Americans, Oregonians, people from across across the country that might care about these lands to have a say in how they're managed. But it also provides a protective framework, but also a guideline for a balanced framework. When Oregon Wild brings litigation, we're typically doing that because we believe that the federal government has violated the law, and we're trying to hold them to that law. If those lands were no longer in federal ownership, it would be a different set of laws that we'd be looking at. I would hope that the state...
Can we just stop there for a second? Yeah, sure. I think this is an important point. And I think this, I was going to say, we shouldn't really talk about the Elliott here, but since you did, let's talk about it. I don't think they are a different set of laws. NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, that's what you would sue under, whether it's a private timber company, a federal owner, or a state owner. It's all the same exact federal laws that you would challenge under, isn't it?
Chair Clem, and
I'm honestly asking the question. So, yeah, I don't know.
So it's correct in assuming that some of the federal laws obviously apply to various actions that are taken, whether they're on federal public land, state land, or private land. But they apply in very different ways. And NEPA, for example, the National Environmental Policy Act, that is only applies to government actions because it is the look before you leap law for the federal government. Mm. California has a similar law for their state.
State or federal? Just federal.
Federal actions. And
unless the state has its own version of NEPA, like
right,
California.
Right, like CEQA in California. And the Endangered Species Act, you know, the spotted owl has been brought up. It's a good example because the Endangered Species Act protects the spotted owl, but management on federal land and on private land is very different, even though they both have spotted owls on them. Part of the Northwest Forest Plan, which was the grand compromise in the mid-90s to solve some of the issues that we had with endangered species, clean water, salmon, et cetera, it really left the private landscape untouched by the regulation or significantly less restricted mm-hmm. by the regulation. And so these laws apply, but they apply in very different ways.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You actually are going right to where I was headed. And
steal your thunder then.
No, not at all. Mr. Stevens, I think there's a perception perhaps by some that if federal lands become state lands, then somehow those lands are less prone to legal challenges, and I'm just wondering, from your perspective, is that an accurate description of what might be the potential for future litigation over forest management, over threatened and endangered species, over clean water, over clean air, over sedimentation, over vegetative management? There is a litany, I think, of, as the chairman has pointed out, of potential litigation. Would that just all become a non-issue at that point?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I don't think it becomes a non-issue. I think one of the things that I'm hoping to highlight is that the framework for management of lands that are owned by all Americans has stronger protections both for citizen engagement and involvement in those decisions, but also for protecting basic things like clean water. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Oregon law is oftentimes not as strong. And I don't think we want to replace private lands law with how we manage federal lands, but I do think that our floor needs to be raised. But that's the way, in a way of answering your question, if these lands were managed by the state or in private hands, I think you would see less challenges because there are less legal protections for those lands under law.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could get a copy of the AG's report, I would very much appreciate that.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Has Oregon Wild ever filed appeal or suit on any harvest on the Elliott?
To my knowledge, we have not.
Okay.
Vice Chairman.
Follow up. Sorry. Yeah. And I appreciate, you know, the photos. I'm just wondering where the devastation from catastrophic wildfire photos are.
Chair Clem, Representative Brocksmith, that's actually a wonderful opportunity to talk about fire because certainly the conditions on our forest lands right now are different than they were naturally, historically. But what we've done, certainly in a place like eastern Oregon across much of the landscape, is we've taken away all of the fire-resistant trees, the big old ponderosa pine. We've had a century of cattle grazing, and we've tried to put out every single fire. And that's actually created conditions that make it so that we have uncharacteristic fire. But fire is also an essential element of a healthy ecosystem, and part of our efforts to put fire out have created problems for communities. And Oregon Wild is involved in lots of efforts across the state to try to resolve that. We work in collaborative stakeholder groups. I know that the legislature has funded that work over the last two biennia, and we feel that there's a lot of work to be done there. It's happening, as Dan mentioned, in stakeholder groups where people come together and try to find solutions under the framework of federal law, though. And that federal law helps to provide the sideboards that make it so that we can come together. I don't think you'd see as much collaboration and cooperation if we threw out the rule book and transferred these lands to the state.
Actually, we got to kind of get going. Vice Chair McLean.
Mine isn't a question, but I just feel because of the just where this conversation has gone in the last 20 minutes that I need to make one comment. As you might guess, most everything you've talked about as far as support, management, caring for our forests, no matter at what level, is very important to me. But one of the issues that you mentioned was that you are looking at the different management, and whether it be federal or state or private, as far as, you know, what are the abilities to have legal challenges, and where do you get the most opportunity for legal challenges. And so I just need to say this, that I try to be respectful of all opinions and every opinion that comes into this door, whether it be someone bringing a resolution or a bill to us, or someone coming to talk pro or con. I try to be respectful and not impinge their motive. And so I felt that happened just a little bit today, and some of the testimony that you brought here today for us. And I just want you to know that two basic foundational issues, if you're speaking in front of me on a committee, and that is I'm looking for best possible management. I'm looking for best possible a collaboration between folks that may disagree on a source or a resource. And I want to make sure that we do it in a way that all Oregonians are going to be able to be proud of this, you know, of this country and of this state. And I'm a fifth generation Oregonian, and all of the things that you talked about today are very, very important to me. But we're on the same team, all of us, and we can look at an issue and we can discuss an issue and we can look at the different solutions. But I think it's really important for us to do it as part of the family. We're all here together. We're Oregonians, people that care about our homes and our communities. So I want to thank you for all the detail. I like facts. I want to see the study, and I'm real interested in where we can go with this. I don't even know if this is going to get a vote. I just know that if we're going to continue conversation in any venue, that it's important to remember that we're all on the same team.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to get on just because we've got a bunch of other people who also want to speak against the bill, and I don't want to be accused of not letting everyone speak. So you had your shot. I appreciate it. We do have some members who I'm sure would be willing to talk to you offline. Representative Wilson's still here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kirk Richardson, Michael Salvaggio, and Tom Wolf, please. Kirk, I've got you first.
Thank you. I'll be the briefest. Good morning, everybody. I'm honored to be here. I was born and raised in Salem, Oregon.
And sorry, you just have to say your name again.
Kirk
for the mic.
Richardson.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. And I'm just here, honestly, to gather information. And this has been really informative. I think you guys and gals are terrific. You've been... it's been a really educational morning for me, so thank you. I'm here as much as anything to just share with you, like you said, Representative McLean, about being part of this Oregon family. I was born and raised in Salem. I had the good fortune of having a father who was active in getting his, at that time, young family outdoors and got to see a lot of the state. I think, fell in love with Oregon at a very early age. And through the good fortune of my life, I've been able to continue to see more and more of the state of Oregon, and it's become a passion for me. And I have a couple concerns that I think beyond this issue of whether Oregon's owned by private industry or state government or overseen by federal government. I just want to make sure that as we go forward, we're living in favor of the future. That, you know, we're all here for a short time, but there's generations and generations behind us that I want to make sure we protect the best bits and pieces of Oregon for all time. You know, I want to see Oregon become the gold standard in the United States of America for places that people want to come live in a sustainable way and live in favor of protecting the gems we've, you know, luckily inherited, right? All of the 13 Western states, and this is kind of addressed to you, Representative Witt, I know this history. Every single one of the 13 Western states was, you know, was made through a variety of means, whether it was treaties with Britain, you know, or the UK, or a war with Mexico. Every one of the states was acquired as a U.S. territory years and oftentimes decades, you know, before statehood was granted. So for me, the question of whether it's federal or state sort of seems, in a way, resolved. And there are, you know, niggling bits and pieces and interesting stories to each one of those, I grant you. But I think in our case, it's pretty clear. We settled a treaty in 1848 with the UK. It was hand in glove with what our boundary with Canada was going to be all about. Oregon became the first of the three states included in the Oregon Territory to gain statehood. It was basically 12 years later. And we've just celebrated that birthday this week. So, you know, we have this kind of legacy situation where Western states are a little different. You know, things west of the 100th Meridian. I think one of you spoke into Oklahoma. I apologize. I think it was Representative Esquivel. Is that correct? The Western states are a little different than you know, what happened on the Eastern Seaboard. And thank goodness they put their passion, their sweat equity, you know, into making that happen. And I just think, you know, it's our job to think deeply, think profoundly about how we sustain this high quality of life. Because I've lived in other parts of the world in my adult life, even having grown up here in Marion County. I lived in Japan for a few years. I lived in Europe for many years. And we have arguably a phenomenal place that we need to be great custodians and stewards of. And as a business person, my only real concern about the future of how this problem or question or issue gets resolution is where on, you know, God's green earth are we going to get the money to do all of this? That's, you know, because I think many of you have touched on the shortfalls in your districts or counties that you're intimately familiar with, you know, in terms of oversight or proper forest management or proper watershed management. And there's not enough to go around. So I worry when you, at least with the current news that you hear, when you've got a, gosh, I don't know, $1 or $2 billion shortfall in revenue in the state, how we resolve these things. So anyway, I just appreciate the chance to come here and hear from smart people about what these issues look like, what the issue is about, and I just beseech you, I ask that you give it really, really careful custodial vision toward what it looks like, not 50 years from now, but a little bit further over that horizon line. Like, what are your grandkids going to say about what we did here, you know, while we had the gavel? So that's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Kirk. And then I've got Mike second.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Salvaggio. I have the pleasure to represent two groups before you whose interests coincide, the Portland Audubon Society on the western half of the Cascades and the Central Oregon Land Watch on the eastern half. We both oppose House Bill 2365. We feel that it's unnecessary, ambiguous, and a possible threat to the natural character of the state. Though the measure may have sought to create an even-handed and fact-based task force, we find that the statements in the measure seem to indicate or at least lean towards a clear premise that we simply cannot support, that the federal lands in Oregon are neither productive nor a vital component of Oregon's character. And this ignores a multitude of Oregonians and out-of-state visitors who currently enjoy recreational opportunities on these lands, who have an interest in fostering biodiversity, or who enjoy hunting and fishing on these lands. While I acknowledge that the measure makes efforts to couch the ultimate intended results as parking these lands in the hands of the state of Oregon, I would, of course, be remiss not to point out that this is a shaky proposition, especially as this week one of our natural resource agencies took significant steps to move thousands, actually tens of thousands of acres of sensitive forest land into private ownership. And in fact, this legislation not only explicitly allows for that circumstance, but also explicitly notes the benefit of that circumstance. So aside from the concern that we have, especially this session, with regard to spending scarce resources on unnecessary task forces, the proposal comes at a time when keeping public lands in the hands of the people of the state of Oregon appears to be a losing proposition. While we don't contest the notion that the state can, in many cases, be a quality steward of public lands and public resources, this measure, the timing of it, and the premises baked into the text of the measure, for us, leaves the door wide open with the prospect of sales to private entities. We urge your opposition, and I will thank you for that.
Before we lose it, Mike, where's the part where it talks about the benefits? I see the word, the potential for the cost of a federal land transfer to require the state to sell transfer lands into private ownership.
Although whereas clauses are, I beg your pardon, Representative Clem, members of the committee, although the whereas clauses are generally not baked into state statute, we feel that they certainly convey a distinct legislative intent with that the task force is undoubtedly going to be looking at if it does indeed get formed. The clause starting on line 25 on page 1 touts harvest benefits not of necessarily privately managed land, but explicitly privately owned forest land.
I see. I just read the other one. I was thinking it's kind of neutral to me. I see your point. Tom.
Representative Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm here representing Trout Unlimited, a group of 3,200 members in Oregon and 155,000 nationwide who are sports persons, hunters, and fishers, and who also passionately see public lands in the United States as our birthright, that hunt and fish there almost exclusively. And as a representative of that group, I'm here to oppose House Bill 2365. And just for a second, let's forget that for the last several years you've seen me testify many times, and you can forget that. And
no, we can't. We may or may not want to, but we can't.
Forget that I'm in a seat. Let's imagine this. This takes place after July 9th, 20 of this year, when I retire. I'd be sitting here either in a vest with waders, with a shotgun and my dog sitting by me, or my backpack on my back. Testifying, because hopefully by then I'll never have to wear another suit again. But I'm just here to point out some brief things. I've sent in testimony. I've sent a report from NSIA on the benefit of fishing on public lands in Oregon, and I hope you get a chance to read this. Just real quick on some money issues. Number one is the cost of task force when you do them is anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000, depending on staffing, depending on if you bring in a private consultant. And I know that ODFW, out of their own pockets, spent almost $100,000 on the HB 2402 task force. So I guess I would just point out that whereas I appreciate the sincerity of Representative Wilson and the others that came up with this bill, and those are questions we need to talk about, a task force that at this point in our economic woes is not viable. Second of all, currently and this is figures I got from the Oregon Department of Forestry. The Oregon Department of Forestry has 220 employees that work exclusively on state forests, and their budget for state forests is $97 million. And that's to manage 800,000 acres here in the state. Now, imagine if we gave them all of the 15.7 U.S. forest lines in Oregon. If you just multiply that by numbers, you come up with, they'd have a budget of almost $2 billion, and they'd have to employ almost 4,000 people. Now, we know that it probably wouldn't happen, but even if we knock it down to a budget of $250 million just for the state forest part, plus added forest fire cuts costs because there'd no longer be federal money to deal with a lot of this, the cost in a state where we're really struggling with budgets. I mean, as many of several of you here sit on the Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee, you know that we're going to have to cut those agencies and all agencies. So whereas I do understand the questions that are out there, it's just not a financially viable issue at this time. Thirdly, the outdoor industry brings into this country every year for people that primarily recreate on public land $614 billion a year into the economy. In Oregon, and this includes hunting, fishing, backpacking, the outdoor industry, people that use it and stuff, is $12.8 billion. And a lot of that is hotels, restaurants, buying food in local stores. A lot of it goes into local rural economies. So we need to be very careful about how we discuss this, because even if we talk about straight transfer of public land, federal land to state ownership, you know that privatization is going to be in that conversation, no longer how we try to do it. So we need to be very careful about it. And thirdly, a number of years ago, I was lucky enough to win an award from my group, Trout Unlimited, and go on the 50th anniversary of our organization to Traverse City, Michigan, and get this award. And the best part of the evening, I sat at the same table with Ted Roosevelt IV, who is the grandson of a war hero who won a Congressional Medal of Honor during World War II, and the great-grandson, of course, of our best environmental president ever. And here I am, the grandson of a illiterate logger and the great-grandson of a German sailor that skipped his ship and fled to the wilds of western Washington County. So needless to say, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of ground to talk. But we had a great conversation talking primarily about public lands, as his family is still involved. He's been the author of trying to organize the Green Party of the Republican Party, and been pressing very hard for conservation. We talked about the importance of protecting public land, the importance of the needs for hunters and fishers and all outdoor people. So I understand this conversation, and I have nothing against ODF. The director of state lands, ODF, Liz Dent, is a great friend of mine. She's great. Her assistant, Brian Pugh, is great. The chief forester, Peter Doherty, is a fellow steelheader. He's a good man, too. But we just don't have the ability right now for the state to take over management. It just, the cost would be too much. If we want to have this discussion without spending a lot of money on a task force, I say go for it. But let's be wise. I think this is a discussion, but we need to protect the public lands. I was privileged years ago, before I did this, of being a youth pastor for 18 years, and I spent my summers taking kids backpacking, fishing, and camping. And inner-city kids that have never been outdoors before, and they were astounded by the beauty of our public lands in this beautiful state. Don't take that away from those kids who still keep in contact, are now taking their kids and even grandkids to those. Protect our public lands. I want to keep them in federal lands, but let's not do this conversation in haste. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I got to get Bob up here because we've got a couple more bills to get to. All right, tell us what the steelheaders think.
Yes, Chair Klim, committee members, thank you. I will be brief because most of our concerns and questions have already been addressed this morning. Any transfer, of course, would have a big impact on public access and public use. There needs to be more attention, as several people have pointed out. And a study would be costly. That's another thing I know you'll take into under consideration.
Ways and Means certainly would.
Yes. But if you desire to pursue this matter, I would suggest that you have a special, well-publicized hearing so there could be more discussion and analysis when there's more time. So I appreciate your giving us time today and talking about this, and we look forward to working with you on this.
Thanks. Okay. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Just a comment, Bob. Appreciate the Steelheaders' opinion. A lot of the conversation that occurred today from a lot of the groups, the gentleman in the back that spoke earlier, was, you know, adhering to federal law and how we need to, you know, adhere to the Endangered Species Act and just federal law in general when it comes to the management of our resources. So I, as a former board member of the Association of ONC Counties, I expect and would be pleased if all of the agencies that are speaking against this, you know, we're open-minded having this discussion, would go ahead and send a letter in support of the lawsuit from the 18 ONC counties to the federal government for not adhering to the law with the management of the ONC resources that clearly described, which have hereto or may hereafter been classified as timberlands, and the power site lands valuable for timber shall, not may, shall be managed for permanent forest production, and the timber thereon shall be sold, cut, and removed in conformity with the principles of sustained yield. And that is at 500 million board feet, as it goes on to say, annually, or half of the maximum annual growth, which is, according to the BLM, 1.2 billion board feet annually. So it would be 600 million board feet. So I look forward to, please copy me on the letters in support of those adhering to federal law.
Thanks. Rhetorical request. Thank you. That's all my witnesses I have. The one thing I do want to say is there were people who I love your right to free speech, but I would hope you would respect others too. People who have criticized even having a hearing on this topic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not a good policy for us to take. When we have people who introduce bills and we have time to just abjectly reject people. Now, I don't agree, as I made clear to Representative Wilson, with many of the concepts, but the idea of not even having hearings to talk about things when we've got the time is not something I think is very helpful, but I respect your right to decry hearings if you like to. I will say, going forward on this, I'm not interested in spending money on a task force. We may end up being able to have Misty staff for free, a work group that could talk about things. But the sideboards for me would be things like buying federal land, not demanding it, could not go to private ownership, no requirements that it be managed for the benefit of the common school fund, which then force land boards into awkward questions. So I would want to set up some parameters so we don't just end up into wide-ranging topics, given the point of the bill is to talk about, I think, state management rather than federal management, but not private management. Vice Chair McClain.
And I want to just make a simple comment because I did, you know, say I don't like the way some people work. We're basically, in my mind, impinging the idea that we would even have a hearing or the idea that we would even listen to a colleague who would bring a bill to us. I would vote no on that bill if it comes back. And most of you had me, if you heard my comments at the beginning, that I think this is a terrible year because of the budget crisis and because of the fact that we'd be taking on more responsibilities that I don't think we have money to do, which was kind of mirroring some of the testimony that you were giving. But I do agree with the chair that we have to be respectful and we have to give time to folks who bring things to us. So I feel like that was a moment for me where I just needed to verbalize that.
Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if you plan to work this bill before you do, I would request that we have an opportunity to have our state forester in, to ask him what it would be like in terms of our resources to manage these lands, and what management of forest lands under a greatest permanent value rule might look like.
Great input.
Thank you.
First of Escobar, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what it's proven to me today is that this thing needs to be discussed. You can't do it in an hour and 20 minutes. You can't put it to bed, or you can't say yes or no. But I think it brings up more questions. The more we talk about it, the more questions arise. And I think the purpose of this, I don't know about Representative Wilson, but my thought was we'll put this thing to bed one way or the other.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know to what degree this would be a relevant point, but since I don't know, we need to ask the question, and that is if we proceed with this issue at all, in addition to the state forester, I'd like to have somebody from Ledge Council in here to answer some very particular questions, one of which is an element of the Elliott State Forest sale is the tribes. And they've not, that's not been mentioned at all here today. So I just, that's an issue that I want addressed to find out if it is an issue.
So I've been thinking more about this whole Elliott question. Obviously, that's not the topic of this, and it's managed by a different entity, not the legislature, and it's has constitutional mandates that other state lands and furlands don't have. But I think we may end up having some discussion in this committee about the Elliott, because I can see that the land board kicked some of the momentum over to us, and I suspect there's going to be a whole bunch of people asking the state to do something in the next 3 months about the Elliott. So whether we like it or not, we may end up talking about the Elliott in this committee. And certainly Chair Witt's going to hear about it if someone wants money for it.
Mr. Chairman, whatever gave you that idea.
So whether we are the land board or not, which we're not, we may end up acting like the land board here for a little while in those discussions. Representative Power.
I've been listening. I know a lot of you have more backstory and have been engaged in these issues longer than I have been at the table in the last 2 weeks. You know, respectfully, I don't think a work group is going to come to any button-down final answers for us if this is a conversation that states have been having since the 1800s. I think what value could potentially come out of it if the majority of committee members decided to move forward is putting a price tag on the responsibilities and opportunities with some of this. But I suspect amid the backdrop of our deficit, or, you know, as others would see it, the costs that we need to raise in order to meet projected cost services, that we would not have capacity currently to take on a lot of these opportunities or obligations.
Typically, the chair will just establish a work group. There won't be a vote on a work group. If we were to pass a bill, I would ask for a vote. But if we're going to set up a work group, I'll just assign people, and I will take that into consideration for topic. Anything else before we move on to Representative Johnson, who's here for his bill? Great. Thank you. Let me close the public hearing. Thank everybody for coming. It is certainly good to have vibrant discussion about public lands, but time to move on to replacement dwellings. So let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2365 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2144 and ask Representative Johnson and Dave Honeycutt to come talk to us about, sorry, it's not replacement dwellings, it's non-conforming dwellings and permits that were not gotten, but land use was once given. Please tell us what this bill is about.
That bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members and vice chairs. Good to be here. I'll have to say that it's nice to have a simple little bill like the previous one ahead of ours, because this makes this seem like a minor tweak.
Right? Good point.
Right. Let's hope that's the case. So, again, Chair and committee members, thank you. Appreciate being here. I probably am like many of you. First of all, Mark Johnson, House District 52, live in Hood River and represent that part of the world. like a lot of you, well, many of you on this committee, most of you, you know, I have a lot of rural areas in my district, and land use issues obviously always pop up. Your inbox is filled with the things about, I try to do this or I'd like to do that, but I'm running into a brick wall with permitting and or land use and so forth. And the issue before us today is one like that. It's I have a constituent by the name of Tom Cavanaugh, who he and his wife have lived in rural Clackamas County outside of Sandy for about 30 years. They bought their property back in 1987, and at that time the property had been split into two taxable lots, a 1.5-acre lot where they have their home and have always had their home, and then another 2-acre unimproved lot. They're retired now, and they'd love to have their son close by, be able to help them to move onto this other piece of property, put up a house for their son so he could live close to them, help them as they go through their golden years and so forth. And they hope that their son would be able to build a home on this unimproved 2-acre piece of property that they own and that they've paid taxes on for all these years as well. So in 2016, Tom began the process, called Clackamas County Zoning and Planning Division to try to get the process moving. The problem is that the Zoning and Planning Department told Tom that it couldn't be done now, not because Tom had done anything wrong, but because the previous owner had neglected to do what he could have done at that point. Previous owner split the property back in 1975 before they purchased the property in 1987, 12 years before Tom and his wife bought it. But the previous owner had gotten a permit from the county for the split, but he'd not developed the whole land use permit for actually putting a dwelling on this other piece of property. So today the property has remained split into two tax lots, but for the purposes of development, Clackamas County considers it just one tax lot. Tom sought permission to split the property and again was told that it couldn't be done. Since 1975, his property has now been rezoned rural residential farm forest, which in this area means 5 acres, is what the minimum is required. Tom's whole property is only 3.5 acres, obviously not big enough to be split into two lots to make it compliant. In some cases, it's smaller to rezone property, require a smaller minimum lot size, but even then, Tom would need at least 4 total acres, 1/2 acre more than what he now owns. So there's really no appeals process for Tom and his family at this point. Some of you, I think you probably have constituents who have encountered this situation as well. Not for anything that they currently did or as the owners of this property, but because of land use laws that have changed over the years since they originally, you know, purchased the property. They're really to no fault of their own. So that's where we turn to our good friend here, the guru of Oregon land use law here, Mr. Dave Honeycutt, who's probably forgotten more about land use than any of us would ever know in this building. And he helped us work on a legislative solution, which became House Bill 2144 in front of you. So with that, I'll let him explain how he thinks this might help this constituent and perhaps some of the constituents you have in your district as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 2144. House Bill 2144 gets us into the weeds of Oregon land use law, unfortunately.
Everybody's really excited about that.
Yeah. Okay. I understand, Mr. Chair. The bill deals with non-conforming uses in Chapter 215 of the statutes. Chapter 215 is the county provision of the statute, of land use provisions. The provisions of Chapter 215 apply to counties, not cities. Mm-hmm. Cities, there is no statutory counterpart for recognizing non-conforming uses in cities. Most cities have provisions in their ordinances that deal with it, but this deals only with counties. What a non-conforming use is a use that was allowed at the time it was created, but is no longer allowed because of a change in the land use regulations. So, for example, if I built a golf course in 1960 on my property, and at the time that I built my golf course, the county allowed me to build a golf course, but today, 57 years later, the rules in effect would no longer allow me to build a golf course on my property, then my golf course is considered a non-conforming use. It was a use that was allowed when it was constructed, but is no longer allowed today. There are two requirements that a property owner has to meet in order to have a lawful non-conforming use. The first requirement is that the use be lawfully established. So you have to, you as the property owner, have to demonstrate that you're at the time that the use was commenced, that it complied with whatever the law was in effect at that time. The second requirement is that it be continuously used. If you abandon your non-conforming use for a period of 12 consecutive months or more, then it goes away and you have to comply. You can restart it, but you have to comply with whatever the current land use regulations are. So really what a non-conforming use is, it's a recognition by the state that there are some uses, that it would be unfair to change the rules on a property owner and immediately eliminate whatever the use that they're making on their property that complied with all of the requirements. The problem that we run into, and this was really a problem from about 74, 75 till sometime in the early 80s when our planning program was new in this state. The problem that we have is that there were a number of folks that could have received permits to use their property, to develop their property, but they didn't seek them. So in other words, someone that owned their property since the 50s said, I'm going to build a house on my property. LCDC, I've heard of this LCDC, and I think my county might have some kind of regulations, but that's communism, so I'm going to go out and build my house. And I don't care what the regulations say. I'm just going to go out and build my house. And so there were people like that. I grew up in Columbia County. We had a lot of folks like that in Columbia County, Representative Witt's district, in the 1970s. And so what happened was that there were people that would do things without getting permits. If what this bill says is if you're in that situation, if you have a use that was constructed, but there was no permits for it, you can go in now, today, submit a new land use application, show that you could have complied with whatever the standards were in place back then, and if you can prove that, then you can get then you can demonstrate that that the use was lawfully established. It's basically because a lot of times what happens is that these properties pass from property owner to property owner to property owner to property owner, and somewhere down the line, whoever owns the property now, they've been paying property taxes with the fact that there was a residence on the property. They go into the county, they ask for a land use permit, and the county says, well, we can't approve a new land use permit because you've got an illegal use on your property. You have a house on your property. It was built in 1975, but the owner in 75 didn't get the permit, so we can't approve anything new on that property. That creates a problem. Creates a problem for the county, creates a problem for the property owner, and then of course it would create problems for subsequent property owners. What we're trying to do here is give people who have those properties the ability to go in essentially and make it right, and make it right by showing that they could comply with whatever the standards were in place at the time that the use of the properties was, the structure was built. So that's the intent of this bill.
Okay, and Vice Chair McClain, I just want to ask, when you say go in for land use approval, what's the scope of things besides getting an additional dwelling? Are we talking even, I want to remodel my kitchen and I can't get a building permit? Or are we talking truly only land use type things like I want to partition my land, I want to get a dwelling right, something like that? And then the second question I've got is, what was the effect of 49 on any of these? Are any of these people, were they able to resolve it through 49?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the first question, what's the impact or the extent of this bill? It would be anything that would require a land use permit. The case that I'm familiar with, and this issue has been around for years. Patty Smith, Representative Smith, who was the Representative Johnson's predecessor, I remember dealing with this issue in the early 2000s, late 90s. So this isn't something new. We've been kicking around this issue for a while. What happens if a county requires a land use permit, then this issue can will arise.
So I'm telling you what, but land use permit's a generic term, so give us a couple examples.
It could be something as simple as a remodeling of the house where you need to pour a little wider, you know, you want to add to the foundation. It could be an outbuilding on the property. Anything that would require, it could be something like, really small.
Yeah, okay.
And in most cases, the property owner, when they go into the county, they have no idea that the house that they have was built without a permit. So it's a unpleasant surprise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And 49.
Oh, how this was dealt with under Measure 49, I suppose if the property owner had held the if it was the same property owner that had built the structure that was filing the Measure 49 claim, I suppose that as a result of the approval of the Measure 49 claim, the property owner could go back via Measure 49 and fix the problem. But most of the time, it's the hot potato where your four owners through, and the guy that screwed it up is dead, or you can't find him. And you know, this is 40 years ago, and there's, you know, you're the one that's stuck with a hot potato.
Okay, Vice Chair McClain.
Well, first of all, I think this is a. It's one of those discussions like the other one we had this morning, that there's a lot of issues to deal with, and even the definition of a land use permit is something, as the chair pointed out, has a very large scope. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of issues to deal with as far as what the impact of this bill would be on overall land use and also on particular configurations of land use under our present zoning. And so, you know, this is something that I'm going to be looking in. If we're going to get a work session on this, then I want to make sure that I've got all my things in front of me so I can actually read those in a cogent way. But the second item is that the example that you used was two things. Number one, somebody didn't follow the rule the first time, and now they're coming in to say, well, but I could have followed the rule if I'd wanted to. And then the second part of it was as far as ownership. And I'll just give an example with Measure, you know, with 37, 49, and the history we've had in the last 10 or 15 years. My parents owned a farm that was, you know, 75 acres in Clackamas County. My mom was the owner after my dad died, and she had a 37 claim, and she got that 37 claim. She didn't want to use it. All she ever did want to, you know, do was possibly have another house for someone to care for her in her failing years. She died just almost 2 weeks short of what would have allowed her to have the 49 claim. She could have had it. But the people who, you know, then inherited that farm could not do it. So I understand that there are issues of ownership and there are issues that come up, you know, that kind of catches a person between a rule. And I think we should always try to make sure that we help those folks that have a legitimate right. But this issue is not, in my mind, that. This issue would change, especially a review process. It would change quite a few things as far as what was allowed as you call it, conforming uses or non-conforming uses. And those terms in themselves are also very detailed and difficult and very essential and basic to the land use system in the state of Oregon. And so, to me, this is not a small bill. This is a large bill. And there are definitions of non-conforming use and conforming use that are extremely important for the official efficiency of infrastructure and the cost of infrastructure in a lot of different places for both cities and counties. And land use is a local decision, and I want to keep it that way as much as possible, whether it is 23 cities, three counties in the metro local process, or whether it's individual cities and individual counties that have the right to, you know, come to the state and say, this isn't working for us. But, and I think that's what you think you're doing, but I think there's implications because of different counties and some of the other rules that they have that fit in and make a difference on how they look at land use statewide. And how they look at land use in their local area. So I think this is a big deal. I think it's an important bill. I am glad you brought it to us because, again, I think you're trying to fix a problem. But I'm not sure that these words do that, and I want to have an opportunity to look at it a little closer.
Other questions, ladies and gentlemen? We'll definitely do some more homework on this. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Representative. All right, we're going to get our last bill in, I swear, really quickly. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2144 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2634. Al and Bob, can you come up and tell us about Person with a disability wildlife laws. Go. I'm sorry. Whoever would like to go first.
Go ahead. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedef. I am the executive director of Visibility Rights Oregon. We're a nonprofit law office in Portland that advocates for all Oregonians with disabilities across the state. The bill before you comes to you because of a call that I received from a person with disabilities who essentially was complaining about his ability to get a disability permit for hunting. So that prompted me to take a look at our state statute that covers that area. Actually, I did not have a solution for his particular problem, but what I did notice when I did that was that the state law wasn't consistent with our other state law governing disability discrimination. So I had a concern that the way that the permit process was structured in our statute was inconsistent with both our state law and the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. And just quick background is that our state law and the Americans with Disabilities Act are very close. They're very specifically designed to be as close as possible. I brought this to the attention of you, legislature, and I ended up sitting with legislative counsel to talk about whether my perception of that disagreement between laws existed or not, and if so, how we could remedy it technically. And that is the bill that you have before you, House Bill 2634. It makes an adjustment to the process for obtaining a hunting, fishing, shellfish license so that the laws are consistent with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Oregon Hunters Association spent over the last decade working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and disability groups on various barriers that restricted them in the relation to hunting and fishing, and we have always been supportive of both groups having those disabled, those non-disabled, having the opportunity to hunt, fish, and recreate. We went over this bill for many hours at the board level. We have had input from the disability community, and we've looked at the ODFW bill analysis. I'm here today to tell you that we think this has a, as written, this bill has a tremendous impact on a recreation that is supervised by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And the board had another conference call last night just on this bill. We're asking the committee if they would look at the workload impact to ODFW in relation to this bill, the cost, and we don't have the answers today that we need in relation to what this bill does exactly, what impact it has throughout the department for fishing and hunting programs. We need some help on that. We need some guidance. The board has asked me to have help on establishing some type of guidelines on how to implement this bill and what the results of that would mean. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my testimony.
Okay, questions for these two gentlemen? So, Bob, maybe we just get a little more specific. What exactly are we doing? I can see it looks like we're deleting. I can see we're deleting a bunch of things that would be in a written certification from a licensed doctor, nurse practitioner, and then just there needs to be, instead of these specific things, one that just states the person has a disability, then describes how it impacts their functions. And at that point, we also have, it looks like, so rather than specific things, it's kind of more of a general description of how it might impact and not quite so specific. And then the ODFW is supposed to create a program that then allows them a lot more discretion, I guess, than just that list.
Representative Clem, ORS Chapter 659A, as well as the Emergent Disabilities Act, has a framework for how an individual with disabilities can request an accommodation to any state service based upon their disability. And mm-hmm. It sets out a list of about 30 conditions that are considered to be disabilities. And the way that the structure works under those laws is that if a person asserts that they have one of those disabilities and they need some type of an accommodation in order to enjoy the benefit of a state program, such as a wildlife permit, they should request, they should assert that they have the disability and request an accommodation, something that will allow them to benefit from that service. And the agency it gets to look for some sort of confirmation of that disability and then see if the request for the accommodation is reasonable. And if it is, then make the accommodation that is requested or come up with a better one. That's the way the general law works. The way that our present wildlife law is structured, it only allows a person to request an accommodation if they have very specific disabilities, not the broad range of disabilities that are covered in the ADA. So only for specific types of disabilities, and then only certain types of accommodations are allowed under that law. So you can see it's a much narrower type of structure than the broader law that governs this area. So that's the contradiction. There's nothing wrong with the law as it is structured now for people who have those particular disabilities that are covered in the law and want those particular accommodations that the law allows. But for a person who has a different type of disability, say a type of medical condition that limits their ability to either hold a fishing rod or a firearm to have ability to walk long distances, right now that person would not be allowed to apply for a permit because there's only a very specific group of disabilities that qualify for that accommodation. Really, we think actually Oregon has a good program. I think it when you look at other states, it's functioned well. The problem really is one of it making sure that our laws are consistent across the board, that all folks with disabilities have an opportunity to request an accommodation, and if it's reasonable, to be able to go fish, to be able to go clam, to be able to hunt, along with their able-bodied peers.
Okay, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That explanation actually helped. I just wasn't getting my arms around this thing.
Yeah.
So I better understand now what we're trying to accomplish. Now what I don't understand on the back end, what does that mean? And real life examples would help me in that regard.
Definitely going to talk about this more before we take any action, because I'm confused too. Because I get the idea that issuing a permit is the service, but the permit is then to go hunting, let's say. So that is not something the state really gets involved with accommodating as the actual activity. It would just be the permit they'd accommodate, but you know they're not going to be providing a motorized off-road vehicle to somebody who has a hard time getting around. I'm also not sure where we go depending on until I hear an example of a real actual person. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's basically my question. So, Bob, is there an example that has surfaced? Has there been a complaint that has surfaced that we're trying to address, or this is this looking at at federal law and our laws and saying this is a good area to attack and to work on and fix.
Representative Clement, Representative Springer, the second, I'm not coming to you with a specific complaint that this would have addressed. The bill has come forward to you because the way that our law is structured, and I, as a person who works in this area, recognizes that there are certain people who might be excluded, who want to hunt, who want to fish, but because of this difference in the law, would not be able to. I make the analogy that there's people who have use a wheelchair and can't get into a business because it has a step outside and they can't get in. And if you talk to the store owner will say, well, I've never had a person with a wheelchair come in here, so I haven't gotten any complaints. Sometimes people are unable to take advantage of something because there is a barrier to their full participation, and that problem may not come to the fore because they are not used to being able to do so. Yeah.
When do you get a chance? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it'd be helpful for me to flesh this out a little more because I could see some potential conflicts arising. I can think of no better than the area in Columbia County that is a very significant area for non-motorized hunting. Mm-hmm. And it's walk, bicycle, horseback. The benefit of that is undisturbed wildlife, and that benefit derives from the exclusion of motorized vehicles. Mm-hmm. Were we to accommodate someone who was not able then physically to be able to use non-motorized transportation, in fact would need motorized transportation in order to be able to access that, could conflict with the very benefit that we've created, which is a benefit because it is non-motorized in the first place. So I would like to be able to flush a lot of this out first.
Great. And before anybody leaves, I've got one quick thing I got to keep quorum for. So Vice Chair Springer.
Very briefly, and let's not go there, but this will be an issue that needs to be addressed for me, and I've already closed up, so I can't look for the word. But could there be an instance where somebody has a temporary issue, gets this permit? Let's not answer it right now. But it's temporary, and so I think that's a lot different than the existing law. We need to look at that.
Great. Okay, thank you. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 34. And colleagues, I just wanted to see if there's anybody who has an issue with taking the OWEB cleanup bill, the packing things in aggregate with a label rather than every single thing bill, and the aligning federal laws around milk and our milk and placing those on the consent calendar.
Yeah, I don't have a problem.
Anybody, any?
The only thing I might throw out, and I just don't even know, is maybe the OWEB bill.
Okay.
Just the way it looks.
Sure. Okay. So any objection to doing House Bill 2254 and 2255 on the consent calendar? Okay, great. Seeing none, we'll add those. And then who wants to do the OWEB bill? One of you two, since you got excited about it.
Yeah, you want to do that? That's great.
Oh, Vice Chair McClain.
That was smooth. One more. Not so much.
I'll figure it out. You don't have to do it outside the committee. Yeah.
I don't like anything.
Okay, thank you, everybody, for your attention today. I'm going to adjourn the committee.
I'll get you on the other side.
Okay. Yeah, there's like three people who want it, so I now have to go sort out the politics.
Yeah, okay. You have to to do that.
I don't have to do it in the committee. I'm going to do it. I just got to go talk to them because three different ones all sent me notes saying I want it.
Okay. So, that's nice for that bill, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I really didn't think we were going to go all the way.
You just...
I really didn't think we were going to go all the way.